gives me great pleasure to welcome Professor Joseph Kalibaras, who works on he's a very senior scientist in a global context on the ecology and environment, and he's worked on a whole range of things, just a list here, from global ecology, global change, volatile organic compound emissions, remote sensing, plant ecophysiology, eco-metabolomics, macroecology, biogeochemistry, environmental sustainability, food security, and I guess he'll cover a few of those in his talk, but he genuinely does publish prolifically in all those areas, so it's a real honour to have him here. In terms of biography, he's quite an easy person to introduce. He's did everything in Barcelona.
That's it.
So, undergraduate, postgraduate, postdoc. He did have some other postdoc, and then assistant professor, full professor, and then he moved from the University of Barcelona to CREAF, the National Centre, the National Research Council of Spain, near Barcelona, and has been there for the last 18 years. So, welcome, Joseph.
Yeah, thank you, I've been there. Hello.
I don't know what to explain to you in this seminar, so at the end what I decided is to put here what I am writing these last two days. I am writing a perspective on all these issues, putting together all these issues, and claiming that we are shifting from a period where the humanity was fertilizing the air to a new period where this fertilization is not so important anymore, and warming is taking over. Yeah. So this will allow us to walk throughout all these issues that we are talking. Yeah. So let's see how this story starts. The story starts reminding that we humans are fertilizing the biosphere. You know that we are doing that because we are increasing the CO2 in the atmosphere. You know that because we are continuously adding nitrogen to the biosphere, to the point that now we are adding more than the natural fixation of nitrogen, so more fertilization. And we are warming the Earth. You all know about that. Yeah? So this means the first thing that we saw is in this, we started studying remote sensing tools that we have talked about during these talks today, and we realized that the springtime arrived earlier. So the leaf onset occurs earlier in all these areas, the northern latitudes. And then we are realizing lately that also, it was more controversial, but every piece of evidence, it seems to tell us that the leaf fall occurs later. This is more recent one. We have just done this paper. So we have a lengthening of the growing period. We are fertilizing, and we are lengthening the growing period. So this means that we are expecting that the carbon uptake of the biosphere is continuously increasing. Mm-hmm. And this is saving us from this, having an atmosphere even richer in CO2. So we expect that. But do we have evidence for that? Let's see. What do we have available? We have available the eddy flux data all over the world. Yeah? We go there, and for example, we do an analysis like this one, and we realize that mostly there is an increase in the net ecosystem productivity. Okay? In most sites. And we realize also that this occurs mostly in those sites where the nitrogen deposition is higher. So again, our hypothesis was good. We are fertilizing and we are getting higher productivities. And then if we want to go not local, but we want to go global and continental and global, we use remote sensing again. And here what we see is that there is, depending, using different databases, in all of them, we have a greening of the Earth. So in all of them, almost 50% of the pixels are greening. So they are increasing their mass. This is in the last 30 years. Okay? And some of them, they are growing, but they are very little. See, 400. And then what we do is we do all this attribution analysis. Each one of these slides could mean a seminar like this, okay? Because I am giving my granted that you believe me, and you should have believed me because everything could be discussed. But in any case, here we attributed mostly to CO2 and less to warming, nitrogen deposition, and land cover change, land use change. So here we are. This is what is mostly established in our models, that we have a world that is increasingly fertilized and with an increasing enhancement of carbon sinks. But there are other signals, other evidences that we ecologists find while we are working. For example, we do a lot of work with dendroecology. And there we saw that even though the water use efficiency increased, there was no clear and no significant growth in the trees all over the world in the synthesis study. Or I put this slide now because we are talking about Africa all the time, with these new tools that we have, with these L1 tools that look at the optical density, and therefore they allow us to follow the woody vegetation specifically. You see that in the places where there is a lot of humans are the places where there is less increase in the woody biomass in the last 20 years. Or if we look at all these databases that tell us about the carbon cycle, what we see is that the increase in the carbon sink uptake doesn't seem to be able to follow the path, the pace, or I don't know what's in English, what the velocity of the CO2 emissions. Or if we calculate this, that we did this last Tuesday, I calculated this, you see that the ratio of land sink to total emissions in the last years is decreasing. So we wonder, maybe, even there are more signals of that. There is a recent acceleration in the concentration of atmospheric CO2. I guess that you all have these numbers in your mind. There is increasing concentrations. Lately we have different values, but the community, the carbon cycle community, thinks that of course this is due to the increased activity of global economy, and 70% in this case was attributed to a deterioration of the carbon intensity. But there is, it seems, a decreased efficiency of natural sinks. So this was the paradigm that was mostly accepted in many of our models, and then we are posing this in question, and because there are many of these other factors that you all have in mind. Yes, we have fertilization, but we don't fertilize with all the nutrients. Yes, we have fertilization, but we also have pollution out there. Yes, we have warming, but at the same time we are running out of water. Yes, we have warming, but very often we have excess of warming. We have heat wave, or what really rises is not the day temperature, but the night temperature. And if this is the case, then what is rising is respiration more than GPP. So with this in mind, let's revisit what we have. Here we put together data from all the forests that for which we have this information on net ecosystem production. By the way, here you see that even if you increase the GPP, here you have the tropical forest, you don't have an increase in NEP, unless you are in a nutrient-rich soil. So nutrients matter more than we thought. Let's see how they matter. We can discuss it. It will be fun. Because if you put the same data but with respiration, then you see that this nutrient-rich forest, they don't need to respire that much. Okay. We were talking about that with you, remember? About carbon allocation to below ground in order to feed microorganisms and these other possible sources of nutrients. And this is the summary of this effort. Even with the same GPP, if we are in a nutrient rich, you end up with a higher net ecosystem productivity than if you are in a nutrient poor. Because nutrient poor, they need to respire more. They need to allocate more energy to get the nutrients. They need to pay more for the nutrients. This is a hypothesis. We need to test all these things. Anyway, this is what we see. And at the same time, let's look in particular to one of these nutrients. Let's look at phosphorus, that we learned at the school that it was very important. And let's remind what we have now. We have a growing demand precisely because we are fertilizing. We have more CO2, more nitrogen deposition and longer growing seasons in boreal areas. So this means that the demand for phosphorus is increasing. But what about the supply? Is it increasing at the same pace? No, because phosphorus is like oil, it's earthbound, and the sources come from the air or from the soil, but all are small and in certain processes. So what do we have? That we are creating a phosphorus imbalance that we think should alter the ecosystems, the carbon sinks, and finally the climate. This is the basis of this project. It's bad time now, yeah? Bad time for a seminar. So, what do? We want to answer what's going to happen in front of this imbalance. And for this factor, like for many other factors, what we do is we work as ecologists at different spatial and temporal scales. So we start asking what happens when you have this imbalance, where you have a lot of nitrogen and less phosphorus, or what happens when you run out of water. In all the cases, what we study is which are the molecular responses of organisms. And for example, we work hard on genetics. Do they quickly adapt? Do they change quickly the genes? We work hard on epigenetics. Are they able to change the expression of the genome, even the same organism? Even if you, Terry, or myself, we go to live now in Lapland, are we going to change all the trees in our nearby forest there in Torelló? If they get drier and drier, what happened to them? And we have realized that they change the methylation, for example. I think I have slides about that. It's amazing. We didn't expect these quick changes, or the metabolomics, or even the chemical ecology. And then we go to the individual level. Individual level, we work with plant physiology and with growth and all these different traits. Then we are very interested to see that what happens at the individual level, what happens at the population level. This is similar to what you are doing, by the way, because maybe the individuals, they don't respond a lot, but if they die, then they have more resources per individual. And if this is the case, the behavior changes completely. But maybe at the end, the production of the ecosystem is the same in your case. Yeah? But even though the individuals have changed. So we work at these different levels. We are really interested in everything related to diversity, species composition, and how all these end up changing productivity, well, in case it does, biogeochemistry, gas fluxes. And then we want to see this regionally and globally. Okay, so this is what we do in this project, by the way, about the phosphorus limitation. It's one project that you are all invited to participate. That is one of the reasons that the builder told me to come here, because we are doing very similar things applied to nitrogen phosphorus imbalance, but it's applied also to climate change and everything related to environmental changes. And in our case, here we are interested in all the biomes. This is the reason we work in Greenland, in Iceland, in Sweden, in Belgium, and China, in Catalonia, in Mexico, and then for the tropics, we work a lot in French Guiana. But we are working a little bit less in Ecuador, Brazil, Hawaii, or Borneo, but we will be really happy to use your plots, your information, and your knowledge, yeah? Because we are, at least myself, I am quite new in the tropics, even though I love them, yeah? Okay. So, and why I talk about the tropics? Because of all these biomes, what we expect now is in countries like Great Britain, or like Europe, the nitrogen deposition is not expected to increase. In fact, has started to slow down. But in tropical areas, we expect them to still grow up. And the tropical areas are those that are usually assumed to be the most limited by phosphorus. We will talk about that, because we have to challenge all these paradigms. I don't think that we have time to talk about that, but at least the established knowledge is that you have ecosystems that are phosphorus limited, so it's one of the places where we have to focus any question related to these phosphorus imbalances. So this knowledge gap is one of the gaps that we wanted to fill with these efforts. Okay, special focus in French Guiana is where we work the most, because there is quite a diverse soil typology, there is a large precipitation gradient, and there is a lot of stuff that is already working there from French science community. Mm-hmm. And I put here some, I put on the slide, yes, because you are is your friend Oriol, yeah? Your friend Oriol, like many Orthodox, they are doing a great job there. And for example, in this Guayafor is a transect, a transect on precipitation. And this is the kind of work that we are doing, for example, with these data sets. This is, we go there and we study whether all these variables related, in this case, to phosphorus or to chemistry in the soil, affect the structural variables and the dynamic variables. Yeah, and we are working hard on that, and we are just starting, and we need to see what do we get. But for example, Oriol, by doing that, is demonstrating that. Is demonstrating at least, or is posing the possibility that what we were taught in school is true, that in the tropical forest, the engineer that drives everything is the plant. The plants are able to get the phosphorus. The phosphorus is a treasure. So what they do is they get it, and even though you are in a phosphorus limited area, you have huge trees, yeah. And there you find the stocks for phosphorus controlled by the plant. Otherwise, we cannot understand all these other relationships. But this is only something that we are doing there. The other thing that we are doing is we are trying to understand all these gradients. In this case, local gradients. You know that in many of these tropical forest areas, you have this topography with small hills, bottoms of the valley. And what we are interested is in studying how these drive the biology, the chemistry, and also the phosphorus availability and how everything is related. And we try to do work with new concepts, like, for example, to introduce geology here. Mm-hmm. Because if you go to the top of the hills, you have all these oxides of aluminum and iron, and you know that they occlude phosphorus. So for all those that are interested in phosphorus, this is really an area of study that we need because we went until now mostly biologists always taking care only of phosphate acids and organic cycling, yeah? And the last thing that we do in all these plots is we are going to fertilize. We have started fertilizing, but again, this is going to take long. And we need to get results. And what we are going to do is to use all this data, treatment data, to describe what's going on in the tropics. And because otherwise all the postdocs that have to leave, they are not going to get anything. But in 3 years more, we'll start having the results of this fertilization. But this means that we are really willing, again, to collaborate with everybody that has long-term fertilization. This is the reason we work with Joe Wright and all these people there, yeah? So anyway, this was, remember, we were in a fertilized wall, but we said, we expected a continuous enhancement of carbon sinks, and we said, well, maybe it's not true because we have some evidence and suggestions that maybe it's not so strong as we expected in our projections. And we said, well, maybe one is phosphorus, one is nutrients that become more limited than we expected. So let's study that. And if we want to study if they are limited or not, we have to study the supply. And for the supply, what we have done is we have now closed the budget in the atmosphere and realize that it's higher than expected. Now we have realized that the emissions are 3 times higher than it was established, 3.4 teragrams. And this now closes well with the sink, with the deposition. And what we do also is we do maps regional like these ones. For example, you see that the tropics receive significant amounts of phosphorus. Here you have the amounts in case we can do something with this, yeah? And of course we're interested in everything, as we said, and we also, for example, study which is the effect on the oceans, different oceans all over the world. In blue you see that the decrease in NPP throughout the years in response to warming is now lower, this decrease, maybe thanks to this deposition. So they seem to play a role, even though they are not large depositions. They seem to play a role in the oceans. We should study what happens in Amazonia from where you have all this dust from Sahara. So this is the supply from the air, but what about the supply from the soil? What's the trend? And for this, we study the phosphatases, and we in all the sites. And then we see which is the relationship with all of them, with all these different approaches, statistical approaches, and different modeling. Our models are not good, you see here, but they are not bad either. Yeah, the observed versus the predicted. Brian is smiling. You do well. This we haven't published yet because we are not happy enough, but we try to improve this. But what we get is these nice maps. You know that if you have a nice map, it seems that you have succeeded already, even though the map is wrong. But we are not sure. It's wrong, no, but with the data we have available, that is not much. Look again, the phosphatases in the tropics, is where you have the most. Yeah. So is where you have everything prepared for plants and for the system to work to get the most phosphorus possible, because you have water, you have temperature, you have nitrogen, and then all these resources, and you don't have phosphorus. What do you have when you invest in phosphatases, for example? Yeah.
So what variables drive this map? It's
nitrogen, temperature, water, clay, by the way, like in your maps, clay is very important, the texture, because clay is very very much related to phosphorus availability and occlusion also. Yeah. But we need to improve that, yes.
So again, I'm trying to interpret this looks really interesting. Are you then highlighting areas where you expect phosphorus to be more limiting or in higher supply? I'm trying to make the link with acid phosphatase and concentration.
It means that you are more desperate to get the phosphorus.
Or desperate to get
the phosphorus. So this means that you have the other resources, so then you need to pay for phosphorus, and usually you can do that when you have all the other resources, but you don't do that when you are here, where even though you have a lot of nitrogen because it's not decomposed because of the cold, it's cold and you have other problems than the phosphorus. Yeah, but this Brian is not published. We need to improve this a lot. Yeah. No. I mean that is not sure. So don't take serious. Let's put this more simple. Don't take it serious. Only to show you that we are interested in knowing how the supply is changing. Because one of the things that we hypothesis is, well, it's true that phosphorus is limiting. It's true that the phosphorus is like oil, is F-bound. But if you have all the other resources, you are disposed to pay whichever price. If you have all the other, if you have a lot of dollars, you can pay for a bottle of wine, 1,000 instead of 10. This is what we pay. Yeah? Let's put this way. But this is the way we look at these issues. Yeah, maybe wrong, but for example, here this is our Mediterranean sites. This is the tropical sites, and you see if you make the ratios of the enzymes of carbon and nitrogen relative to the enzyme of carbon and phosphorus, you see that here. You can distinguish clearly the tropical. So this is real data from our group, from all these experiments. Yeah. So there seems to be the ability of enhancing this obtention of phosphorus. But then even with that, if you calculate the phosphorus needed for the biomass projected for the next decades in all these models, that climate models, and then or even if you calculate the NPP phosphorus needed. The amounts are always quite high and very often above the nitrogen limitation range or phosphorus limitation range. So we think that our models were over optimistic, and in fact the mass that we can project is lower. And it's not only here we do it regional. Again, for you to pay attention to the tropical areas. Depending on, we calculate different ways, yeah? If we do it just stoichiometrically, depending on the stock, this is what we get. If we do based on NPP, the phosphorus needed, but based on low recycling, this is what, but if there is high recycling, then you still have these limitations, yeah? And this is what we do, but other groups, this is American one, they presented this more nicely. That maybe you have this in mind.
Mm-hmm. Could you go back to that previous one there?
Excuse me?
The previous graph, please. Yes. I want to understand.
I didn't explain. I'm going very fast. It's only I have thousands of slides. This is unfair to you. But here we calculate the phosphorus needed in the next decades in case we assume that the cycling of phosphorus is slow. So let's put this the most the less optimistic scenario. And here is an optimistic scenario assuming that there will be a high recycling, that the plants, the microorganisms are going to be able to recycle as much phosphorus as possible. Because one of the hypotheses is, as we said, if you have a lot of CO2, if you have a lot of energy and resources, then you produce a lot of enzymes that, for example, liberate the phosphorus from the organic molecules, or they even produce citrates and all these other acids that even liberate the phosphorus from the inorganic materials, you know, by exchange. Mm-hmm. So there is this doubt, because we say there is no phosphorus enough, but there are people that say, well, there is not enough, but in a future world, then the mechanism will be developed to get this needed phosphorus. Yeah? And here this is from American group. As I said, this here is more intuitive what you see. Okay? So this is it. And we are an example that nutrient limitations may counterbalance what we said at the beginning. But air pollution could do the same, but I am not going to show any slides on air pollution. But let's go to warming. And for warming, you also have all these other climate-related factors that could have negative effects on these carbon sinks. And we have the heat wave. You all remember this heat wave of 2003? Europe became a source of CO2 instead of a sink. You have what we saw recently, that the sensitivity to warming, to temperature of leaf unfolding, is decreasing. So there is a kind of acclimation. Now we need a much more a much warmer environment in order to change the days of the spring. Let's put it this way. I didn't explain well, but you understand what I mean or not? Yes, sure. Yeah. So the sensitivity is decreasing. There is a kind of acclimation. Now, if in the 80s, for every degree of warming you advance your spring 4 days, now it's only 2.5. So it's not what we expected. Yeah. Or if we look at the effects of the different temperatures, we realize that yes, the maximum temperatures translate into NDVI growth. Yeah. But if we consider the minimum temperature, then it's a negative response. Yeah. And the minimum temperatures are the ones that have increased the most. They have increased 40% more than the maximum temperatures. The night temperatures have increased more than the diurnal ones. So there are all these. And also, if we go and look net carbon exchange by using inverse modeling from the CO2, you realize that in the boreal areas there is a positive relationship with maximum temperature with the diurnal one, but negative with the nocturnal one. And even if we look at the amplitude of the yearly CO2 concentration, what we see again is that there is a negative relationship with the minimum temperature. And we could go on, yeah? And we have a lot of doubts about all this. But we know from the literature that warming at least is related to all these changes, that mostly they are here in red, meaning that they are not in favor of carbon sinks. And we pay special attention to these two biomes, the tropical one, And the Arctic and boreal ones, where we have accumulated huge amounts of carbon, like in the tropical one. Yeah, look at that. Imagine this, in the temperate forest we bother about, like those ones in the Mediterranean or those ones in Germany. Yeah, they only represent 41 relative to this. So if this starts warming and we start losing this carbon, then we have a much stronger effect, even if we run out of the whole temperate forest. Yeah? And well, in any case, all this, we know that there are all these relationships with warming, yeah, related to changes in the optimum temperature, to the deficit, vapor pressure deficit, and soil moisture, higher risk. All this we know. And I'm not going to detail, but this is known. So this is relative to warming. but even associated to warming, there is drought. So another climate that is not in favor of enhancing carbon sinks again. Yeah. Why? Because we may have longer periods with the leaves, but for example, in the Mediterranean, we know that when you are thirsty, they stop working. So even though there is earlier spring and later autumn, it doesn't mean that you have longer growing period. Yeah. And here we do the same. Let's put another example, like in all these factors. We again study the response to warming and drought, following all these different scales, and with experimental efforts, with observational efforts, and with modeling efforts. Yeah, and here we do in French Guiana, but I am really sorry because I cannot explain much. As I said, in the tropical area, we still are struggling to have the results. But the easiest is that I show you what we do in our Mediterranean sites, where we simulate drought. And there, what do we see when we simulate drought? For example, in this shrubland. 10 years ago, we were amazed to see that there is experimental evidence for selection response. Many loci, of the plants that were grown under drought, after only 5 or 6 years of experiment, they had their genome changed already. They had several loci that had changed. We were amazed to see that. We saw similar things in observations in the field with beech trees, also. And then in another of these experiments, in this case is in a Holmok rainforest fusion experiment, we saw that there are changes in the DNA epigenetic methylation, and they were related to those, many of those. We were not able to realize what was the role of those genes, but those that we were able were related to osmotic relationships, for example, to favor osmotic protection, just by expressing or not the gene. So this means that the same tree, after 10 years, has a different epigenome. Yes. So they are able to, the message is, organisms, they seem able to quickly respond to these environmental changes, much faster than we thought. And then when we study the metabolomics, we see that the metabolism of drought plants, it goes more to secondary metabolites than to primary metabolites linked to growth. Or we see that it's completely different between roots and leaf. Yeah, this is for you. Yeah, the roots, they seem to respond immediately with a different metabolism. They start growing more. They have more amino acids. They have more sugars. And instead, if you go to the leaf, what they have is more terpenoids, more phenolic compounds, more protective compounds. Yeah. So this is another thing. The different organs, they respond differently. And then, of course, you also have changes in phenology. But at the end, you don't need to be very wise to realize that at the end, if you have less water, you grow less. Yeah. My grandmother that lived in this farm rural areas said to me that there is not fair that the government spend money paying me to say that if you have less water, you grow less. Yeah. So, but at the end, this is what we have there. Yeah. Okay, and then we also have in the drought and warming climate, you have less recruitment. This is different for different species, but for example, those species that live in drier areas are those that are gaining dominance in the community after many years. So the community is starting to change, you see. And the species that are characteristic of a little bit wetter areas, they are decreasing with time in these experiments. So this means that the community's composition is changing. And if this is the case, what happens with the production of the ecosystem or the community? The relative to the control, the drought decreases a lot, and now seems to be a dampening. But it's a dampening that it doesn't mean that the same plants are able to adapt. But in this case, it's because there is a turnover of species. Mm-hmm. And warming, yeah. So all these are changes we can expect with whichever of these environmental changes we are talking about. This is about experiments, but about observations. We have had all these last years in Europe, warmer and warmer, and then drier and drier. And here you have what happened in Spain with all these dominant three species. And you see that every time that there is a drought period, there is an increase in the defoliation. Something so simple like the defoliation. We use here the data from the foresters, the national inventories. So it's plenty of opportunities to follow all these questions. And here, then we realize that this is what has happened in Europe. Nothing in the north and the central, but an increased defoliation in the Mediterranean areas. And this was started in the late 80s because here in Europe there were the problem that was attributed to acid rain. But this was great because now we have all this information of all these plots throughout the continent.
This is individual crowns losing the leaves, or is it trees dying, shrub dying?
No, this is the foresters go to they followed particular trees throughout the time, and they say, well, this defoliation is 25%, 50%, and then you make the average of many of those.
Okay.
So it's very simple. It's a forester monitor. These days they also do soil analysis, air quality analysis. It has improved the monitoring, but in the old times they did this, but this was enough to realize that we had this important change because of drought, that at the end it translates into less carbon uptake. And this is one can wonder, you have defoliation, but does it mean that you have less productivity? At the end you can live with less leaves if you are tree. But then this fits very well what we see with the dendroecology. The last years have been a decrease in the growth of the tree rings. Yeah? Not only in our area, but in all this Mediterranean, of Morocco, Italy, and Greece. And again, we go to global. In US, you had this decade, all these droughts, these famous papers that I guess that you remember, most of you, those of you that come from US. Yeah? Or maybe you remember also this paper by Steve Running, very controversial too, because they use this, again, this MODIS MPP, yeah, that we discuss whether we trust it. But in any way, in all these cases, what they show is drought. And again, they show no soil enhanced carbon sinks. So all these are examples that decrease these carbon sinks, I mean. But we also have, I am not going to talk about that, because we are talking about many things already. But in the land use changes, you have afforestation and reforestation that will go the other way around, enhancing them, yeah? Okay, but this is not so simple. So remember, because this is a mess. The first thing is, we all think that we are fertilizing this planet. This means that the carbon uptake is increasing. But then we realize that maybe it's not increasing at the pace our models think. And now we just show that, but with all these examples that show less primary productivity. But it's not the carbon sinks, they not only depend of carbon uptake. This is the driving force. But they depend on elasticity, and especially they depend on turnover rates, whether the carbon remains in the stocks. Yeah? And this is also dependent on all these variables. And we could repeat that, but we are not going to worry because I don't want to punish you. But we could go on with all these examples, and here we have that, for example, the CO2 is supposed to decrease, the turnover rates, eutrophication is supposed to increase, but decrease. So at the end, what we have is this. This is what I was writing this week, and the referees are going to keep. That if you put something so simple like the sensitivity to the amplitude of the yearly change in CO2, remember it in Mauna Loa or in Pambarro, let's go to the northern latitudes that are more sensitive. In the 80s or the 70s, there was a positive effect of CO2, but nowadays it seems to start disappearing that. And the same happened here in Mauna Loa. Mauna Loa is not significant. I have to change that. I have to put no line because it's not sensitive. But what happened with the sensitive to temperature? It was positive in the 80s, but now it's negative. So this is the point that we have the fertilization seems to be taken over by the effects of warming, at least in the northern latitudes. And here it's the same year here, the 90s, the same year you have this decrease also in Mauna Loa. Yeah? So this is not demonstrated, but they just post here the first story today. That was to to pose this possible shift in periods in the Anthropocene. Until now we were fertilizing and strong carbon uptake. Now the warming is and the lateral effects of these global changes, they seem to end this capacity of strong capacity of absorption of carbon. And if this is the case, if we put all this now, this is what we are doing, we put this in the models, then we have a warmer prediction for the next decades. And if this is the case, then we realize that, for example, the heat wave, like the one in 2003 that we had in here in Europe, and with a scenario of plus two, we have much more frequently, but with all these changes, we have reached a scenario of plus three, that means that every 2 or 3 years, we have one of these heat waves. And if this is the case, this is a disaster. Maybe you remember what happened economically, sanitarily, and because our society is not even though we also adapt like the other animals, maybe not so fast as if this is the case. And we know what happened in nature, because we have had examples of that. And now, for example, we see abrupt changes in the Eastern Iberian Peninsula. After the 80s, there was this change in this drought index, meaning that after the 80s, they became much drier than before. And what happened there? That the carbon uptake and the growth of the trees, they decrease abruptly, and this is what we have now. And in fact, we have seen this several times throughout the history of this planet, because this landscape in Almeria was a forest only 4,000 years ago. So we are used to this, yeah? And at the end, this is the end of this story that I wanted to tell you today, yeah? That it seems we're a little bit worried, because it seems that the capacity of sink, of carbon sink, maybe we have has been overestimated in our models, because we didn't take into account all these other possible factors that limit the effect of fertilization of CO2 and longer periods of activity. This is one thing. There are two other stories, but I'm going to go fast because it's late, because it's kind of torture to have you here in the afternoon. And I'm going to go fast, but only because in the talks this morning and yesterday and this afternoon, I realized that the remote sensing is also important for some of you. All these issues that I have presented before, we try to assess them a lot by remote sensing. And we try to develop new tools that allow us, for example, to assess NPP or to assess photosynthesis. And this is based in something very simple. Who was telling me about zinc? It was you that, yeah. The zinc, look, here I apply your hypothesis. Maybe I will steal your slide if you allow me. Yeah? But imagine that the concept of zinc is really important, also at the level of reducing power and energetic status of the cells. And the hypothesis here is when you have an excess of reducing power because the zincs are not powerful enough, and then you have low photosynthesis, for example, then you emit signals that are visual and even odorous or gaseous. And if we're able to use them, then it is when we can estimate all these processes with remote sensing tools. And with this in mind, long time ago, who was in Stanford? We were talking about, look, here is with Chris Field and Zoger and all the guys. When I was there, it was a kid like you, for example. This is long ago. So we decided that this is even the same slide, simple slide of those days. You know that the energy that reaches the chlorophyll goes to carboxylation, but if this thing doesn't work, you need to dissipate the energy, otherwise you get burned. And by dissipate, how do you dissipate the heat? Well, there are different mechanisms, but one is related to the formation of a pigment. If you form a pigment, and this is going to absorb the light, and if it absorbs the light at determined wavelengths, then it's going to change the reflectance, it's going to change the color. So this was a wonderful opportunity. So, and we thought, well, if we look for these wavelengths where you have the maximum absorption, and we relate it to another one where you don't have absorption by these pigments, then you can define this photochemical reflection index that is going to give us an indirect estimation of photosynthesis, and light use efficiency. And we have done this throughout the years, and it's very controversial because there is never perfect, nothing perfect in science. But it works quite well for an ecologist. It's at least we very often obtain R squares or variable explanation of variance of 60-70%. This is a lot in ecology. We always make the joke, especially when we discuss with physicists. During these years, we have improved the way we define it by relating it to zero bar and all these kind of things that we don't have time to talk about. But we have tested them in all these FluxNet towers where EBI or NDVI don't see anything in the evergreens, and then PRI follows it. Yeah.
Is this from a tower-borne sensor or a tower-borne measure?
Yeah, this is from the tower.
Yeah.
This is in Italy, and this is in the pine forest here in between Canada, Alaska, and northern US. You see this one is improving and improving now. You see here with PRI, you see here with EDI or NDVI, there is an improvement there. It's very similar to this is for all the forests. It's not perfect for the whole of them. It depends also on the characteristics of the biome of the forest, so it's difficult to get a general algorithm. But we are working on that. In parallel, we are working with sun-induced fluorescence. I put this one because you were talking about this paper by Joe Berry, assuming that the near infrared would do the same job. So just to remind you as community, as a group, that there is an effort in the remote sensing community to take the maximum advantage possible of the reflectors. And now we have more and more satellite sensors that we have sent in along with and playing with that too. So this I'm going to skip. But at the same time, because we also talk about VOCs, remember that we can consider that this excess of reducing power, it also translates into the production of isoprenoids. And volatile organic compounds, and this drives us crazy as ecologists and biologists because we love it, yeah. Because they are great as a language of communication in life, and they are great for plant protection against high temperatures, oxidative stress, high light. They also are useful for the plant defense in front of herbivores, or to call the attention of the predators of the beavers, or they call the attention of pollinators, and they are good also for food dispersal. Oh no, they are also play a role when the plants fight each other, and by the way, then the roots now is amazing because you know this film Avatar, I thought it was crazy, but now we realize that maybe it was not so crazy.
The communication between
the roots, it
yeah.
seems that they
change nutrients.
That the change of nutrients, they recognize each other, so this may be play a role, but this is, as biologists, is something that we really are interested in, but also as environmentalists, all these gases are produced and they generate the secondary organic aerosols that your friend Kulmala is the king of, and then they are related to climate and all these things, so they are really important. This is very lately one where only alpha pinene is able to generate a secondary organic aerosol. So they are important, and they are changing, like it happened with the previous history about carbon uptake. VOC formation is changing also because of all these different global change components. And we want to follow, as for carbon uptake, we also want to follow VOC production all over. And to do that, everywhere and all the time, or most places, most of the time, the tool is remote sensing. So again, we want to link it to remote sensing, and what we have is GOM and all these satellites that give us formaldehyde. But formaldehyde is not there are a lot of uncertainties in the oxidant chemistry of isoprenoids to form formaldehyde. So we are not happy enough. So we need a very simple thing. What we did for PRI, we think that could work also for isoprenoids because the underlying physiological processes are very similar. So the excess of electron transport and reducing power is also favoring the formation of these VOCs. And you have more excess, the lower the photosynthesis, the lower the steam. And then, so this all is like, we had, well, this should work also for remotely sensing isoprenoids, remotely sensing. And I'm going to go fast. I'm sorry, it's only to remember that you can do that. So there is a relationship between excess of reducing power and isoprenoids with all this at the leaf level, with different species emitting isoprene or monoterpenes under drought or control during in sun or shade conditions. And in all of them, we see these relationships between these indices related to excess of reducing power, optical indices, and this emission. And we're even going to put it together. It's noisy. Again, I told you, we are really happy when we have this kind of variance explained. But if we want even to get it better, we use some of you, maybe you know Megan and all these models that based on climate and characteristics of the biome, they forecast the emissions. And what we claim is that what they give you is the capacity, but then if you use PRI, you have very nice estimations of the emissions. Yeah? And this is what we're seeing in towers like this, again, towers. These days we use PTR-TOF, and we are able, the community is able to measure this the same way we measure CO2 or N2O or methane. And we go, I put this in honor of the Catalan group. Yeah, here I see three faces of this, three Catalan. And we do that there, and we do all these campaigns with tethered balloons and aircraft, and one thing that amazes us is always this, always heterogeneity, complexity, life. This is the magic of life that makes our work difficult compared with physicists. We always discuss with physicists, yeah. But for this, I am going to go further. But these are the slices, horizontal, and you see that they change a lot, even for the water or for the VOCs. Yeah.
So how is that information captured?
We have mast here distributed throughout the terrain. And with the balloons, and then we do a digging, I-grigging. You say digging, how do you say? We invent with the model interpolate, excuse me. And then you have the model interpolated, and you see how variable it is with this slice of five kilometers here and 50, yeah, in this forest. And then you integrate, and you see the differences. It's not always a matter of biomass, but a matter of the characteristics as emitters of these VOCs. And then what I wanted to end up with this, even at these scales, it seems that there is good relationship between this PRI and everything related to the emission of these compounds, even when we go global with GOME or this satellite. Now they are improving a lot. But even if with these ones, the product they produce and the PRI are not bad. We need to work more on this, but the idea is that we biologists should take advantage of what we know about the physiology of the plants in order to understand how do they perform and the signals they emit, both as in form of gases and in this case in light. Yeah. And this was the second history, or history, no, story, but what do you say? History is for Oxford, story is for the state.
Story.
Okay. And this is the last one. The last one is, of course, when one become old and has gray hair, we want to save the world, and we want to apply everything that we do to more societal products. This is the reason, for example, that everything that we have taught is linked to these risk items that are identified for many international institutions, like the greenhouse gas emissions, climate. Food security issues, income disparity, yeah, mineral resource supply. We didn't talk about that, but the phosphorus there is really important. How do we share the phosphorus mine products? This is really important. This is one of the reasons that the U.S. is in favor and protects a lot Morocco, for example. Yeah. There is a lot of policy here. But anyway, so the idea is that our group is to account for what we are doing with climate and nutrient feedbacks, to put a little bit of realism and feasibility in the policy goals of all these societal and economic models. For example, when we have this business as usual scenario where we lose many of our tropical forests because there is an extension of arable land of people needed to eat, yeah, and do that. All this is if we make a rational use of fertilizers and phosphorus, for example. So we want to put all this into this task. This is the effects of climate change on the productivity of these different main sources of food, main cereals. And the idea is to even recover all ideas. This was the, for example, we talk about this for the Catalan people there with Margarep and all these guys. Yeah, we think that maybe we should consider to feed the animals with recycled phosphorus, for example. And with this, we develop all these scenarios where we can reduce a lot the fossil fuel market share. Yeah, the best scenario that we think is not to use algae and plants for bioenergy. This is for the Polytechnical University, but to feed the animals, because we are consuming a lot of land and resources and energy feeding animals for our food. So with this, we can end up with all these targets that the politicians, for example, reach in their meeting in Paris at the end of last year. Was that yes? Mm-hmm. So we discuss whether this is possible or not, whether we need to add these biological inputs or the carbon uptake and how this is possible or not. And so the first story is this one. This is the one that I like the most because it's the one that I have to finish this weekend. Yeah, and then this is the story that we claim that we are shifting a little bit the period from fertilization to warming dominated world. This is to remind that the sense of reducing power can provide us very good signals for the moment sense, all these issues, or for assessing them with odor, or with the gases that they emit, yeah? And the last story, very short story, is that our research on natural ecosystems and earth system should be interconnected with the societal, the human environment. At the end, we were talking in the bike. Humans are no more than animals because we are animals, so we are part of nature. We behave like this in the same laws, but we should take this into consideration. So this is it. Huh? Okay, sorry to have you here. Well, 1 hour is too long, right?
It's perfect.
Thank you. So thank you for listening.
Okay.
That's it.